This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, we're going to do something a little different. We're hitting the road with KCUR's community engagement team. Laura Ziegler and Ron Jones have spent the past couple of months in Liberty as part of an ongoing project at KCUR called Here to Listen. So this morning, we'll be tagging along. Here's Laura.
So Sunday, maybe the best day of the week to peek into the history of Liberty, Missouri.
God, continue to lead us and guide us as we do this together with you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Let's stand now and sing together this hymn of community.
The light beams through the tall stained glass windows here at the Second Baptist Church. It's just off the historic square. Second Baptist was established in 1843, and it's not even the oldest church in town. The Disciples of Christ, the Presbyterians, Methodists, and Catholics were already here. Some were meeting in churches, others in makeshift buildings, even in outdoor gatherings. Like the Baptists, they'd come here to the Western frontier in the early 1800s, seeking a better life and on a mission to convert other settlers and Native Americans. But the influence of the Baptist Church became one of the dominant forces at the time and has one of the most enduring legacies in Liberty today. It was this issue of missionary work that caused a split in the early Baptist community. Associate Pastor Connie McNeil says today's Second Baptist Church felt the Bible instructed them to do missionary work. There was another group that didn't see it that way.
That group remained First Baptist Church, and this group said, well, you know what, let's not fight over this. You'll read it the way you read it, we'll read it the way we read it, and we'll just become Second Baptist Church.
The original First Baptist Church eventually died out, and today the Second Baptist Church is home to business and political leaders, professors, and past presidents of William Jewell College, another of Liberty's flagship institutions. We'll hear more about the connection between Second Baptist and William Jewell later in the show. But first, to stop at what today is Liberty's First Baptist Church.
Okay, now this is First Baptist Church.
The historic church is on Gallatin Street. It's just a few blocks from Second Baptist, where we just were. Dr. Cecilia Robinson organizes walking tours of Liberty's African American community. On a warm August morning, she's leading a group of a dozen or so walkers, most of them white, some from Kansas City and some from Liberty. She tells them that there's a friendly rivalry between this church and their friends around the corner.
We have two Baptist churches here. Both of us claim that we were the first. Okay. 1840s, Second Baptist Church was established. 1840s, First Baptist Church was established. Okay? Now.
Robinson's an emeritus professor at William Jewell and has written extensively on the history of the local black community. She's standing in front of the simple brick building and explains it was started by enslaved people brought to Clay County by their masters from Tennessee and Kentucky, from the Carolinas and Virginia. These white settlers had smaller farms and for the most part came with fewer slaves than owners of the big plantations in the Deep South. Although they still regarded people as property, and Liberty was known for slave auctions and slave hunters, historians like Robinson believe these masters could be more permissive than those elsewhere in the country.
The two groups had church in the courthouse. They would share the communion cup. Some of them who had masters who were kind, somewhat liberal, they would allow them to have church on their own. So we met up there in the courthouse. And then there was an old barn they met at.
I got joy in my soul. All right, come on. God is in control. All right. I got Satan on my trail.
Today the church is thriving with an engaged congregation as it gets ready to celebrate 175 years in the area.
As you come out of, think about coming out of slavery and being in a situation where someone owns you and those kinds of things, the church would be the place that you could go and you could talk to God about your situation, because we didn't have buildings and places that we could go other than the church.
There's another church that has a very important role in the history and spiritual fabric of Liberty and Clay County. That's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Many know members of this church as Mormons, but this summer, the new president of the church urged congregations to use the name the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as revealed by God to the prophet Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. Russell M. Nelson says Mormons, or even Latter-day Saints, are nicknames, and the church should discourage their use. First, here's a bit of history. Followers of the prophet Joseph Smith came to the western frontier from New York. When they arrived, they didn't really fit in to the southern culture the earlier settlers had established in the area. The Northeast was becoming more industrial, Missouri more agrarian, more like the South. They didn't own slaves, and they were seen as having different religious and cultural beliefs. The newcomers were persecuted and fought back in violent skirmishes throughout the area. Smith and some of his followers were jailed on charges of treason under an order of execution. So we'll begin our story here at what's known as the Historic Liberty Jail, where Smith was imprisoned. When you come into this exhibit, there's an audio program to go along with a facsimile of the jail where Smith and his followers were held in the winter of 1838 to 1839. The display shows the inside of a sparse basement with cast images of the prisoners. Elder George Peterson says there's a reason Mormons flock to this historic site.
Because there's a special spirit here that resonates because of what happened here.
Missouri Governor Lilburn W. Boggs had issued an order to expel all members of the church from the state in the 1830s. Peterson says it reinforces the visitors' faith when they see how badly the prophet and his followers were treated.
They didn't just harbor ill feelings, but they actually turned to Jesus Christ and trusted him.
Leaders say this history is at least partly why members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are coming back to Northwest Missouri. They still make up just a very small fraction of the state and of the mushrooming population in Clay County. But according to one study, since 2010, church membership has almost doubled in size in Clay County from about 1,000 to 2,000 people. Good jobs, new houses, and top-notch schools are also reasons members of the church are coming back. But one of the biggest reasons, people say, is that 6 years ago, the church built a temple just outside of Liberty in Kansas City North. There are 16 million Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints members across the globe. There are only 157 temples. The exterior of the double-spired temple is bathed in sunlight one Sunday morning recently when I was there, casting the entire eastern front in an almost mystical rose-colored light. The temple is reserved for the most holy rituals, like baptisms and marriages, which are believed to seal a couple together into eternity. So sacred is this space that non-church members are not even allowed to go in. But visitors are welcome in the small building next door. It's called the chapel. When I come into the chapel, a bunch of teenagers are just getting out of their 6:30 a.m. religious school class. The girls are wearing nice dresses and the guys are wearing coats and ties. They seem eager to talk about their identity with the church, what's good about it and what's challenging. 14-year-old Hannah Wheeler has bangs that just hit the top of her stylish glasses. She likes that her church community or ward is growing at school.
There are a lot of people who moved in recently, and we moved here like 4 or 5 years ago, and since then we've seen other people move in, and I know a lot of people in my church, my ward, they live close to me, and it's really cool to just get to know them.
Harrison Wheeler says sometimes he feels like he sticks out, like he has to explain some of the rules that he lives by.
Most people are pretty nice about it, but I do get a lot of questions about just different things, like for example, we don't date till we're 16, so I get questions about that. And just stuff like that.
And when they do date, the kids are supposed to go in groups to avoid tempting situations. They're not supposed to drink, and they're expected to dress modestly. It seems like this could be hard for some high schoolers, but it doesn't seem to bother these kids. Here's Briley Hansen.
Like, girls have, oh, you should date this guy, or, oh, you should say these things or dress this way, and the guys are like, oh, you should do drugs and you should play football and you should be like this image that everyone thinks that guys should be. But everyone can have a way to stay true to their standards instead of adapt to what everyone else wants them to be. So.
A 2012 study by the Pew Research Center found that the majority of members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints say a lack of understanding of their faith, discrimination, and a lack of acceptance are among their biggest problems. But Rudy and Lori Garcia are eager to pull back the curtain and openly celebrate their faith. When I got to their house, Rudy had just gotten back from working at church. It was mid-afternoon, and he'd been there since 5 in the morning. But before he even changed out of his church clothes, Lori and their two sons, Ethan and Ashton, gathered around the piano to sing. Sundays in the Garcia home are reserved for family and God. They sing, they play games, and they pray. Lori and Rudy met as students at the University of Kansas. She's a take-charge, gregarious former television reporter who grew up in the church. Rudy was raised Catholic. He says he's always been a seeker. And while the church doesn't require them to observe a Sabbath day, Rudy says their family makes it a priority.
When the Royals won the World Series a couple of years ago,
that was so hard.
We chose not to watch it on TV, and we found out the next morning what happened through social media. But it was a preference and decision we made, knowing that the decisions we make now long-term will pay off.
One time I did buy an oven online on the Sabbath because it was like some big Thanksgiving something Black Friday sale. We had the worst trouble with that oven. It came in, it was the wrong size, it was the wrong order. It was just a nightmare, and I thought, see, you shouldn't buy things on the Sabbath.
Gathering around the kitchen table, the family recites a prayer. Then they go to this week's article of faith or guiding principle the church members live by.
We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and doing good to all men.
Indeed, everyone's already looking at their phones. That's where they pull up the websites that have all the scriptures and the lessons. Now they simply flip over to their calendars to check in on what's going on this week.
This is going to be a crazy week.
Maybe.
Okay, so Monday, Ethan has JV. I have a meeting with the library at 1. Rudy, just a heads up. Okay. Ashton, play practice starts?
Monday.
Okay, and what time? You said it's a longer time?
It's 2:30 to 5:30.
The Garcias live west of I-35 in Kansas City North, but they consider themselves from Liberty. They say many of the new members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are moving into the same areas. County records indicate the church also is acquiring land at a rapid rate, which isn't uncommon for other parts of the country where the population of the church is growing. Jeremiah Morgan is president of the Liberty Stake. That's a collection of some 11 congregations, kind of like a diocese. He says the church is constantly buying property to fund its work here and abroad. He knows people sometimes question the growth of the church in the area.
You know, maybe if it was truly dramatic in terms of, you know, tens of thousands, that would certainly be something that might draw people's attention.
Morgan's ancestors were some of those who were persecuted and chased out of Missouri in the mid-19th century. His grandfather helped exhume the body of Joseph Smith to keep hostile mobs from stealing and desecrating it. Today, he's not interested in focusing on this troubled past.
I don't want that to define us, because really, it changed the way we were as a church. We're more reliant upon, you know, and understood what we needed to do to get along with others, to be better community people in some ways, and in many ways, a better people.
That'll bring up second down, 11 yards to go.
The Liberty North football game is the biggest game of the season, and Ethan Garcia is suited up with the Liberty Blue Jays. He's got one buddy from church who's also on the team, but it's not about the church tonight. He says his church values are always with him. Tonight, it's all about the team.
We want to win, but like we also want to maintain friends, and like if you get a good hit roll, we don't like go and tell them, hey, you suck or anything like that. End of the game, whichever team wins. Whichever team loses, we got to congratulate them for them trying hard and putting all they can into it.
And soon, Ethan will be 16. He'll be taking a Liberty North cheerleader to the homecoming dance this weekend.
The That's KCUR's Laura Ziegler. Today, Laura is taking us on a trip to Liberty, Missouri for a special project here at KCUR. It's called Here to Listen. In a minute, the story of an iconic teacher who worked at a black school in Liberty back when the schools there were segregated. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to this special edition of KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's show is all about Liberty, Missouri. Let's head back there now with KCUR's Laura Ziegler and Ron Jones.
Okay, so we heard about this next story on one of our early visits to Liberty. We were holding listening sessions where we meet with people from the community just to learn about what's happening there. Someone brought along Shelton Ponder.
Now, before we get to Shelton Ponder, Laura, I want to start out at a tour of a very special school in Liberty. It's called the Garrison School, and it was an all-black school until schools were integrated back in the 50s. Dr. Cecilia Robinson leads tours of the school today.
Sometimes you think that integration hurt us in some ways because the teachers who were here were so good with the children, knew the children, cared about the children in so many ways. It was like an extended family.
Dr. Robinson points out a painted mural on the right side of the brick building.
So that's what you see, and that class that you see there was one of the segregated classes. And so that man in the corner next to the lady with the glasses, Mr. Gann, he was a mathematician. I mean, he had a master's degree in mathematics. Liberty made him the playground monitor.
Oh my gosh.
Before being demoted to a playground monitor, Clarence Gant was responsible for educating generations of African Americans in Liberty. He had graduated from the Garrison School and went on to Lincoln University in Jefferson City, where he played football, baseball, and was a member of the debate team. He returned to Liberty in 1932 to teach at Garrison, the only school African Americans could attend back then. A year later, he was named principal and held that position for 35 years until the Liberty schools were integrated. And here's the amazing thing. It turns out Clarence Gant's grandson, Avila University professor and director of the Center for Digital Advocacy, Dr. J. Anthony Snorgrass, is my closest friend. So close that I call him Joey. I had never talked much with Joey about his grandfather or knew about their close relationship and all of the archival materials he had, ranging from photos to letters, certificates, etc. That's where Shelton Ponder comes in. Turns out, Ponder has created a one-man show about Professor Gant.
My name is Clarence Edward Gant. That is Gant with two T's.
As it turns out, Shelton Ponder is a 75-year-old man who was raised in Liberty. He's a poet, an author, and an actor. This one-man theatrical performance is all about the life of Clarence Gant, who was one of Ponder's teachers in the 1950s. Gant had a huge effect on Shelton Ponder, like he did with so many others in the African-American community. So I thought it would be remarkable to get Ponder together with my friend, Dr. J. Anthony Snorgrass, to share their memories of Clarence Gant. We start with some of Ponder's performance, Mr. Gant Modified.
I was born to Smith and Pearl Maxshears Gant of Liberty, Missouri, on February 9, 1903, right down there on Schrader Street across from the cemetery. Some other people born in the first decade of the 20th century were Langston Hughes, Thurgood Marshall, Zora Neale Hurston, Bing Crosby.
Today, I'd really like to focus on my grandfather as a teacher, because I never got to be a student of his in the traditional sense. Certainly in the life sense, yes, but he was my grandfather. Grandfathers always instill knowledge across the next generation, but it's taken not as a student-teacher relationship.
He would ring the bell in the mornings, and when you approached him, you said good morning. That was part of that social interchange that we had to have, good morning, and the first things that you did when you saw him. And it wasn't hi or and all of that. You spoke distinctly. And that was the part of that thing that you were being taught from the minute you walked up those stairs until you left. There was something happening. And even though we were in you know, they'd have more than one grade in the room, you learned what was going on in the second grade because you were in, I was in the first grade. And then, you know, he would come down the hall or come down the steps, and sometimes he'd just come in and observe, turn around and walk out.
So education started the moment you hit the stairs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
With the grading, set the tone for the day.
Yep. I knew Mr. Gant from seeing him in the community, but also my brothers talked about, you know, like he was known in the community. And the fact that they had attended Garrison for 3 years before I had even started, you always heard stories. Something happened. Mr. Gant did this, Mr. Gant said that. But at early ages, we were being mentored by Mr. Gant without even knowing it. Yep, tuck your shirt in, tie up your shoes, take the gum out of your mouth, don't throw it down on the ground. I mean, all those things right there were, like, you know, you put a tape in, it would be the same every morning. There was always that presence. He was bringing something to you. When he said, boy, everybody stopped. That was a firmness, but you knew he cared about you. All the teachers cared about us. We were like a big family at Garrison.
So in the play, there are several acts, and I had the pleasure of seeing the first in Liberty, when you premiered it in Liberty, or was
that? Oh, no, I did it in Liberty. I did it over 30 years ago for his sisters. It was about their brother or their brother-in-law, and they liked it. Writing this script was not hard. It was something that was in me. Mr. Gant was that man that every young man would want to aspire to be. As I began writing it, it was just to recall the different situations that took place, how Mr. Gant handled them, what he was showing and teaching at all times without beating it into your head. It was just a matter of observation. And we all walked away with a part of Mr. Gant in us. The one thing that I was able to do and that I chose to do was to put it on paper and to present it to other people. And as I began writing it, the more I wrote, the more I came up with the world situations, whether it was Jack Johnson becoming a heavyweight champion, whether it was Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics, where he won 4 gold medals. So all the things that were in the play were things that happened either in Mr. Gant's life, but things that were happening in different parts of the world. When he comes to Liberty High School, he's designated as a study hall monitor. How he handles it, it's so significant. There's nothing that some people were upset about, well, you're, you know, taking this position. But to me, to convey that, he stood as he had always stood. That's it. Now, at Garrison School in 1954, the Supreme Court decision stated that all segregation would cease with all deliberate speed. Unanimously, the Supreme Court voted 9-0. Well, I received a communique stating that grades K through 8 would no longer be in existence after 1958. And none of the teachers were going to be rehired. That meant they had to find teaching jobs in Kansas City or somewhere else. Well, there was much disappointment. And some of the parents felt like I should have been angry or mad because I was going to be assigned as a study hall monitor at Liberty High School. He was the man of style all the time, impeccable. When someone defined me as coming out impeccably dressed, I wasn't seeking that. But to portray Mr. Gant on stage, to portray your grandfather on stage, it had to be as close to him as I could get. I mean, as far as the suit, the shoes, the shirt, I mean, everything. But that's what we saw every day.
He did his thing in the classroom. He was very influential there. But he was also known as a stand-up guy in the community as well.
He did not run away from community issues.
No.
He was on point with them. So the fact that he knew just about everyone in the North End had taught the children's children.
Yes. Okay. Generational.
Generational, yeah. Put him in a position to also represent interest of the community to the larger community of Liberty. Can you talk to me a little about that?
The organizations, whether it was the Masons or there was a civic improvement organization. He was affiliated with that. I was in Boy Scouts. He was there in Boy Scouts. Children who had never had an African-American teacher, if I could say it, the best person to be that was Mr. Gant, because that's what he did. But the fact that he was able to come into this situation and even to help the kids who may have been apprehensive, they knew him. Now, I tell you what, I know there's a lot of things you remember, but a couple of things that you remember most about your grandfather, Mr. Gant.
My experiences with him it was always something that was looked forward to. It was always something that I was sad to leave, because I would come and spend summer time with him.
Man.
So I'd get out of school and I'd get to go to Liberty to hang out with my grandfather, to go fishing, to play ball. And he had the keys to the recreation center, so I always was able to get any kind of athletic equipment that I wanted to play with. So it was like, this is fun times and learning times as well.
Right.
Probably the most thing, not interactive, but just being around him, was being in a man's space. And at the time that I spent many summers in Liberty, he was a bachelor. So there were man things, you know, in the house. I remember going in his bathroom and for the first time seeing a double-edged razor. And I started playing with it. He told me not to, but I did anyway. And I remember cutting my finger on it. Okay. Because it's very, very sharp.
Okay.
And I didn't realize that. And I remember there being Cornhuskers lotion. You know, because that's outdoorsman kind of lotion.
Yeah.
You're a fisherman, you're a hunter, you have that. And I remember him actually helping to bring me into manhood. Because, by the way, I mean, I was 16 years old when he died.
Okay.
So most of the time that I spent with him, I would have been 12, 13, 14 in those developmental years. I slept on a cot in the living room in his house, and it was just the most wonderful time. Of course, there were a lot of lessons that I had. The first time I ever cleaned the fish, didn't do it real well, but he taught me that, because we go fishing in the morning, we catch, we're done by 1 o'clock, we come home, and I'm thinking that's the end of it. No, now we got to clean these things.
Okay. Continuation
right,
of the
right.
project.
Right, we got to clean them. Okay. And then, you know, the joy is you have a fish fry that evening and the whole community would be there. So I remember those. Wow. It was a lesson in that for the hard work.
What was he like that separated him from the other people who were around?
Now I'm not going to say I didn't listen to other people.
Okay.
But what was significant is they listened to him.
Okay.
So most of them were listening to him. So I'm going to listen to him over them most of the time, because it was like they were still being counseled as well.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So I want to go to the source for my knowledge. So my grandfather was the source. So I got that sense. Hmm. And he had other grandchildren too, my brother and my sister.
Yeah, right.
I was the oldest and probably spent the most time with them, but they were around as well.
On February 9th, 1968, Mr. Gant celebrated his 65th birthday. On February 11th, 1968, Mr. Gant died. He did not leave behind buildings bearing his name, a fleet of ships, his memoirs, large bank account. But what he did leave behind were students and teachers who were beneficiaries of his teaching inside the classroom and outside the classroom. Mr. Gant, Mr. Clarence Edward Gant, a true Renaissance man.
That was Dr. J. Anthony Snorgrass and Shelton Ponder talking about the iconic teacher and grandfather, Clarence Gant.
And that was KCUR's Ron Jones. He and Laura Ziegler have been visiting with people in and around Liberty, Missouri. Next up, the role William Jewell plays in the town's identity and where that might be headed. This is Here to Listen, a special episode of KCUR's Central Standard. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's show, we've been in Liberty, Missouri as part of a special project called Here to Listen. Every couple of months, we go somewhere in our listening area and take a closer look at what's happening there. KCUR's Laura Ziegler is our guide.
So now we're going to go up the hill on the east side of Liberty to William Jewell College. It began as a Baptist college and now is a small liberal arts school with red brick buildings and lovely shade trees. There are some 900 students here, and even between classes, it feels calm and relaxed. There's a new glass commons area with beautiful views and comfy hangout areas. This place is open all night. It's an intentional recognition that some of the best ideas and thinking come at odd hours. Standing under the towering columns of Jewell Hall, Vice President Clark Morris points out the original brick that was ferried up from the river by oxen in the early 1850s. This building was used during the Civil War.
For the Union Army as actually a stable for cavalry horses on the first level, as barracks, and then also as a hospital. That was because there was a battle, sometimes called the Battle of Liberty, sometimes called the Battle of Blue Mills. And so they began to fortify this hill in anticipation that maybe Liberty was going to be invaded.
Jewell Hall, of course, is named for the college's founder, Dr. William Jewell. He was a successful physician from Columbia, Missouri. Today, many in Kansas City recognize the name of William Jewell because of the internationally known classical arts series, the Hiram and Jewell series. What you may not know is that the founder of this series, Richard Harriman, once did a great service to a little-known opera singer. Luciano Pavarotti had his very first American recital debut on the William Jewell stage in February of 1973, thanks to Harriman, who was the director and founder of the performing arts series that bears his name. Harriman had heard the stunning tenor at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Pavarotti didn't even have a manager, and Harriman connected him with one just so the college could book him. The Hiram and Jewell series is just one of the things that attracted Elizabeth McLeod Walls to William Jewell in 2016.
So I was a competitive pianist growing up, and I was also a cellist and performed in the youth symphonies in Lincoln as I was growing up, and then had the opportunity later in life as a professional to give back and to support the Lincoln Symphony, which is a fantastic organization.
So when McLeod Walls became president of William Jewell, she fit right in. I recently sat down with a new president to talk about the deep relationship the college has with the town of Liberty and the challenges that the school is facing. William Jewell, about 928 students, almost 1,000.
About 900, yep.
And you came from Nebraska Wesleyan, about 1,700
mm-hmm.
students. Talk about some of the particular stressors that small mm-hmm. liberal arts colleges are facing today.
Sure. Well, you know, these things are cyclical. And when you have a really robust economy, as we do right now, and a post-recession sort of viewpoint about higher ed, so more skepticism, more caution about that investment.
In other words, families just being more cautious about their investments.
Yeah. And, you know,
and their debt that they want to take on.
Exactly. And what we're finding is that this Gen Z that's coming up really doesn't want to have any debt. And there's an association in the consumer's mind about small private institutions being excessively expensive. One of the things that we are working on and that I hear my colleagues at other small private colleges working on is reshaping the narrative so that we actually do a better job of explaining to our consumer how affordable we are. The truth is that most William Jewell students pay about $20,000 a year to attend, and that's all in. That's tuition, room, and board. Whereas if you look at the flagship state institutions, MU is $28,000 a year and KU is $26,000. So we're very competitive when it comes to places that historically people have thought were more affordable. Mm-hmm. And we need to do a better job of explaining that.
The $20,000 figures in what the average student might get in financial
aid.
Right. Right? And including possibly academic or athletic scholarships. Mm-hmm. Everybody's not going to get that.
Right.
I mean, everybody can go to KU for $20,000 or $25,000 in-state.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. On the other hand, we have very few students who are paying full freight. Very few, as in you can probably count them on two hands. 99% of our students get some kind of scholarship or financial aid from us. And we take that very seriously because we want Jewell to be accessible for everyone, not just the high-achieving student or the student with resources. But I do agree that right now, small private colleges have to make a stronger argument if we're really going to be relevant.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the core curriculum and the Uxbridge.
Yes.
What are those?
The Critical Thought and Inquiry core curriculum is unique to Jewell. So this curriculum is required of all of our students. It lasts the full 4 years that they're there. So 25 years ago, we went away from a distributed model of general education. And instead, so that's what you and I would have experienced in college. So that's,
you have to take
you gotta take
history,
a math, you gotta take an English, right. And instead, and of course our students get all of that content, but instead we created an integrated curriculum that asks the challenging questions of life. So every single course you're gonna take is gonna ask you to really interrogate what is real, what is truth, which is a very pertinent question for our culture right now. How do we know what we know? And then how do we live according to what we know? Those are the three big questions of the core curriculum. And they carry that with them like muscle memory when they become professionals and citizens in our communities. So we take that very seriously. It's very important to us. The Uxbridge Honors Program is also unique. It is an Oxford-style tutorial curriculum in which students will be in tutorials of two, maybe three other students. It models the Oxford system all 4 years that they are at Jewell. And then they spend their junior year at one of seven Oxford colleges with whom we have a relationship.
So let me address the college student today, many of whom are looking at college very differently than you or I might have because of the job market. Right. And they're maybe not as interested in the humanities and the philosophy, the social sciences, the arts, et cetera, because they're looking to get an education that's going to get them a job.
So there are, if you will, pure liberal arts colleges out there. There's very few. In the 70s, we made a shift and we added nursing and we also added business because we decided that a liberal arts education, if you will, critical thinking needs to be applied to all professions. It's not just something you experience in a philosophy class or an English class. So we graduate nurses, business majors, civil engineers, data scientists who are critical thinkers and who spent time with those three big questions that we talk about in our core curriculum, but who also can communicate effectively, can write effectively, can have strong interpersonal skills. Those are the kinds of professionals that we need in business and industry.
So let's talk about the budget for a minute. You inherited a budget that was challenged, right? That was taking too much out of the endowment and putting the college's endowment at risk.
I would not say it was putting the endowment at risk. We had developed a habit. And that habit was essentially when we had a shortfall between revenue and expense, the board would authorize us to expand that endowment draw beyond what is industry standard, which is roughly 5%.
Right.
And this followed a separation from the Missouri Baptist Convention when the college almost instantly experienced an enrollment drop because we had all of these feeders coming from churches.
And quite a bit of money, right?
Yes, although that's true. And so our response to that was to make preparations to grow enrollment and obviously to grow the endowment. And those things happened to an extent. But really over the last 10 years, we have not been the enrollment size that we were when that break occurred. And so in response to that, we used our own resources in order to meet the gap. Here's the really good news for Juul is that we have incredibly low debt, so a 4-to-1 endowment to debt ratio. We have really strong liquidity. We have a very, very good financial responsibility score by the Department of Education. So financially, we're really strong, and we bring in a lot of wonderful gifts every year from our supporters and donors.
In that effort to write the budget, you had to make some cuts. Mm-hmm. You cut some programs. I think you had to go to some personnel. How did you make those decisions, and how are they affecting William Juul mm-hmm. moving forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have a responsibility as an organization. We had a deficit, so we needed to address that. We did it in the right way. We did it in the Juul way. It was extremely collaborative. And faculty and administration came together to establish shared principles by which we were going to make decisions. And at the end of the day, those shared principles really rested on preserving who we are academically, so the core, Oxbridge, you know, what we're known for and why we matter, and then preserving the student experience. For tenured faculty, that was exclusively, they had the option of raising their hand to take an early retirement package. And several did, and that made our situation much better.
You cut some programs in, is it studio art or arts? And some languages?
So the faculty came together and looked at a lot of data with regard to all of our programs. And the programs that had almost no majors in them and hadn't for about a decade, but also, and this is key, in the case of art, for example, we had two faculty members in the art department. They both raised their hands and chose to retire, and that particular department had almost no majors. And so we made the decision, especially with KCAI down the street, just doing incredible things. We're not a studio art place, really. We're a musical theater place. We're a theater arts place, and we have one of the strongest music programs in the state of Missouri. That's where our strengths are. Studio art is being handled beautifully by another institution. So that's how that decision was made.
Languages?
Languages, you know, we didn't have very many majors in French, for example. And so the faculty decided to close French. But in that particular case, we have a faculty member who is still with us and teaching in the core curriculum, and it's simply courses in the major that we're no longer offering.
Let me come back to the marketplace that we were referring to earlier, how you attract students and increase enrollment. I know that you require students to live on campus. Is that all 4 years?
It is right now, yeah. Uh-huh. We are critical thinkers in community pursuing meaningful lives. And when we developed that philosophy, which was about 2 years ago, we challenged ourselves to apply that to all aspects of our living and learning community. Not just, you know, we're happy critical thinkers living together. It's, okay, we have to start interrogating every single policy and practice. And if we truly want our students to go on to lead meaningful lives, then we owe it to them to have the challenging conversations about, you know, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. So our students have challenged us on this 4-year requirement, and we take that seriously. I think things have changed. You know, students today get a very meaningful learning experience getting off campus and experiencing things in the city. And, you know, almost all of our students do an internship or have some kind of experiential learning opportunity. And I think that creates a kind of a really healthy restlessness with our students. And so we're trying to respond to that. So it's a very topical question. We believed in it at one time. And right now we're asking, is this something we should still believe as critical thinkers in community together?
Are you hearing from people, from prospective students? Are you getting questions about that?
We do. Yeah, uh-huh. All the time. Yeah. We know it's something that we need to be talking about.
Let's go back to the history for a second about the connection to the Baptist Church. I want to listen to Eleanor Speaker, who's the mm-hmm. historian with Second Baptist Church, on the connection between William Juul and the Baptist Church.
Well, the professors, the administration at William Juul, were often the people who pastored this church. And both the church and the college were short of funds all the time and just struggling. And so together, they managed to get through things.
So to what extent is the college today affiliated or associated with the Baptist Church?
So we were not founded by the Baptist Church. We were actually founded by a charter of the state of Missouri. But our founders were Baptist. And so historically, our religious affiliation has been Baptist. And that lingered, obviously, until the early 2000s. So it's a very important part of our heritage. We have chapel on campus weekly. We have very robust co-curricular offerings and Christian student ministries and other ways in which our students can engage in spiritual exploration, which remains a value of William Jewell. And we're proud of that history. I mean, there's a lot of rich history, as she alluded to, with Second Baptist and other Baptist organizations from across the state and frankly, the nation. But we haven't been Baptist. We've never officially been a Baptist school. And we haven't been affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention, which did supply us with funding. Because they endorsed our mission, but we haven't been affiliated with them since the early 2000s.
So is William Jewell a secular college?
No, we're not. We're a college that celebrates the sacred, but we don't affiliate with any particular denomination.
That was William Jewell College President Elizabeth McLeod Walls. A couple of other things about Jewell's break with the Baptist Church. It's important to say that one of the things that precipitated the separation from the Baptist Convention was the college's support for students who'd voted to add sexual orientation to the college's anti-discrimination policy. That's why the Baptist Convention cut ties with the college, as well as that financial support. McLeod Walls also talked about how William Jewell's trying to open its doors to the wider Liberty community. It's got funding to do a project that will refurbish the side of the campus that spills down the hill right into the historic Liberty Square. She says the idea is to say to their students and to residents of Liberty, this is your town's college. We want our students to be in the community, and we want to welcome you all here. One of the most popular community events is the Fall Festival in Liberty. Last weekend, high school marching bands, cheerleaders, and football teams paraded up Kansas Street and around the square. Churches, community groups, political candidates, and their campaigns walked the streets throwing candy into the buckets of children lining the curbs. Before we came, we heard people in Liberty were nice, that we wouldn't hear very much negative stuff. And for the most part, we didn't, at least not on the record. What we did hear were stories of a very rich and sometimes troubled past and how communities are coming to terms with that legacy today.
This special edition of Central Standard was produced by KCUR's Laura Ziegler and Ron Jones and edited by Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Mike Russo. Today's Focus on Liberty was part of a KCUR initiative called Here to Listen. Every couple of months, we are traveling in and around the metro to listen to your stories. We really want to know why we should come to your community. If you want to make a suggestion for our next Here to Listen destination, go to our website, kcur.org/here to listen, or tweet us. We are at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman. Tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard, it's our first Friday art show. We'll hear about an exhibit curated by teens at the Kemper and more. Tune in at 10 to start mapping out your arts agenda this October. And if you missed yesterday's show with Kansas author Sarah Smarsh about poverty and class and how she's experienced those things in her life, you can still hear it. We keep all our past conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Now, stay tuned for Up to Date.